Hello? The line hissed and crackled, as if the call were coming from a long way away. The voice at the other end of the phone was unfamiliar.
Mr. Mayhew,
it said.
Mr. Richard Mayhew.
Yes, he said, and then, delighted, you can hear me. Oh, thank God. Who is this?
My associate and I met you on Saturday, Mr. Mayhew. I was inquiring as to the whereabouts of a certain young lady. Do you remember?
The tones were oily, nasty, foxy. Oh, yes, that's you.
Mr. Mayhew, you said Dorr wasn't with you. We have reason to believe that you were embroidering the truth more than perhaps a little.
Well, you said you were her brother.
All men are brothers, Mr. Mayhew.
She's not here anymore, and I don't know where she is.
We know that, Mr. Mayhew.
We are perfectly cognizant of both of those facts. And to be magnificently frank, Mr. Mayhew, and I'm sure you want me to be frank, don't you? Were I you, I would no longer worry about the young lady. Her days are numbered, and the number in question isn't even in the double digits. Why are you calling me?
Mr. Mayhew,
said Mr. Croup, helpfully.
Do you know what your own liver tastes like?
Richard said nothing. Because Mr. Vandermeer has promised me that he's personally going to cut it out and stuff it into your mouth before he slits your sad little throat. So you'll find out, won't you? I'm calling the police. You can't threaten me like this.
Mr. Mayhew, you can call anyone you wish.
But I'd hate you to think we were making a threat. Neither myself nor Mr. Vandermeer make threats.
Do you, Mr. Vandermeer?
No, then what the hell are you doing?
We're making a promise?
Said Mr. Croup, through the static and the echo and the hiss.
And we do know where you live.
And he hung up. Richard held the bat phone tightly, staring at it. Then he stabbed the 9 key 3 times. Fire, police and ambulance. Emergency services! Said the emergency operator. What service do you require? Can you put me through to the police, please? A man just threatened to kill me, and I don't think he was joking. There was a pause. He hoped he was being put through to the police. After a few moments, the voice said, Emergency services? Hello? Is there anyone there? Hello? And then Richard put down the bat phone and went into his bedroom and put his clothes on because he was cold. And naked and scared, and there wasn't really anything else he could do. Eventually, and after some deliberation, he took the black sports bag from under the bed and put socks into it. Underpants, some T-shirts, his passport, his wallet. He was wearing jeans, sneakers, a thick sweater. He remembered the way the girl who called herself Dorr had said goodbye. The way she had paused, the way she had said she was sorry. You knew, he said to the empty flat. You knew this would happen. He went into the kitchen, took some fruit from the bowl, put that into the bag. Then he zipped it up and walked out onto the darkened street. The ATM took his card with a whir. Please enter your PIN number. It said. Richard typed in his secret PIN number, D-I-C-K. The screen went blank. Then, please wait, it said. Somewhere in the depths of the machine, something grumbled and growled. This card is not valid. Please contact card issuer. There was a chunking noise, and the card slid out again. Spare any change, said a tired voice from behind him. Richard turned. The man was short and old and balding, his scraggly beard a matted tangle of yellow and grey, and the lines of his face were etched deeply in black dirt. He wore a filthy coat over the ruin of a dark grey sweater. His eyes were grey as well, and rheumy. Richard handed the man his cash card. "Here," he said, "keep it. There's about £1,500 in there, if you can get to it." The man took the card in his street-blackened hands, looked at it, turned it over, and said flatly, "Thanks a bunch. That and 60p will get me a nice cup of coffee." He gave Richard his card back and began to walk down the street. Richard picked up his bag, and then he went after the man and said, "Hey, hang on. You can see me." "Nothing wrong with my eyes," said the man. "Listen," said Richard, "have you ever heard of a place called the Floating Market? I need to get there. There's a girl called Dor." But the man had begun nervously to back away from Richard. "Look, I really need help," said Richard. "Please?" The man stared at him without pity. Richard sighed. "Okay," he said. "I'm sorry I troubled you." He turned away and, clenching the handle of his bag in both hands so they hardly shook at all, he began to walk down the high street.
"Oi!"
hissed the man. Richard looked back at him. He was beckoning.
"Come on, down here, quickly, man."
The man hurried down some steps on the derelict houses at the side of the road, garbage-strewn steps leading down to abandoned basement flats, and Richard stumbled after him. At the bottom of the steps was a door which the man pushed open. He waited for Richard to go through and shut the door behind them. Through the door, they were in darkness. There was a scratch and the noise of a match flaring into life. The man touched the match to the wick of an old rowerwoman's lamp, which caught, casting slightly less light than the match had, and they walked together through a dark place. It smelled musty, of damp and old brick, of rot and the dark.
"Where are we?"
Richard whispered. His guide shushed him to silence. They reached another door set in a wall. The man rapped on it rhythmically. There was a pause, and then the door swung open. For a moment, Richard was blinded by the sudden light. He was standing in a huge vaulted room, an underground hall, filled with firelight and smoke. Small fires burned around the room. Shadowy people stood by the flames, roasting small animals on spits. People scurried from fire to fire. It reminded him of hell, or rather the way that he had thought of hell as a schoolboy. The smoke scraped his chest and he coughed. 100 eyes turned then and stared at him, 100 eyes unblinking and unfriendly. A man scuttled toward them. He had long hair, a patchy brown beard, and his ragged clothes were trimmed with fur, orange and white and black fur, like the coat of a calico cat. He would have been taller than Richard, but he walked with a pronounced stoop, his hands held up at his chest, fingers pressed together.
"What? What is it? What is this?" he asked Richard's guide. "Who've you brought us, Eliaster? Talk, talk, talk."
"He's from the upside," said the guide. Eliaster, thought Richard, was asking about the Lady Dor and the Floating Market. Brought him to you, Lord Ratspeaker. Figured you'd know what to do with him. There were now more than a dozen of the fur-trimmed people standing around them, women and men and even a few children. They moved in scurries, moments of stillness, followed by hasty dashes toward Richard. The Lord Ratspeaker reached inside his fur-trimmed rags and pulled out a wicked-looking sliver of glass about 8 inches long. Some poorly cured fur had been tied around the bottom half of it to form an improvised grip. Firelight glinted from the glass blade. The Lord Ratspeaker put the shard blade to Richard's throat.
"Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes," he chittered excitedly. "I know exactly what to do with him."
Chapter 4 Mr. Croup and Mr. Vandemar had set up their home in the cellar of a Victorian hospital closed down 10 years earlier because of National Health Service budget cutbacks. The property developers, who had announced their intention of turning the hospital into an unparalleled block of unique luxury living accommodations, had faded away as soon as the hospital had been closed, and so it stood there, year after year, grey and empty and unwanted, its windows boarded up its doors padlocked shut. The roof was rotten, and rain dripped through the empty hospital's interior, spreading damp and decay through the building. The hospital was ranged around a central well, which let in a certain amount of grey and unfriendly light. The basement world, beneath the empty hospital wards, comprised more than 100 tiny rooms, some of them empty, others containing abandoned hospital supplies. One room contained a squat, giant metal furnace, while the next room housed the blocked and waterless toilets and showers. Most of the basement floors were covered with a thin layer of oily rainwater, which reflected the darkness and the decay back toward the rotting ceilings. If you were to walk down the hospital steps, as far down as you could go, through the abandoned shower rooms, past the staff toilets, past a room filled with broken glass, where the ceiling had collapsed entirely, leaving it open to the stairwell above, you would reach a small, rusting iron staircase, from which the once white paint was peeling in long, damp strips. And if you went down the staircase and traversed the marshy place at the bottom of the steps and pushed your way through a half-decayed wooden door, you would find yourself in the sub-cellar, a huge room in which 120 years of hospital waste had accumulated, been abandoned, and eventually forgotten. And it was here that Mr. Krupp and Mr. Vandermeer had, for the present, made their home. The walls were damp, and water dripped from the ceiling. Odd things moldered in corners. Some of them had once been alive. Mr. Krupp and Mr. Vandermeer were killing time. Mr. Vandermeer had obtained from somewhere a centipede, a reddish-orange creature almost 8 inches long with vicious, poisonous fangs, and was letting it run over his hands, watching it as it twined between his fingers, vanished up one sleeve, appeared a minute later out of the other. Mr. Krupp was playing with razor blades. He had found a whole box of 50-year-old razor blades, wrapped in glassine paper, in a corner, and had been trying to think of things to do with them. "If I might have your attention, Mr. Vandermeer," he said at length, "pipe your beady eyes on this." Mr. Vandermeer held the centipede's head delicately between a huge thumb and a massive forefinger to stop it wriggling, and looked at Mr. Krupp. Mr. Krupp put his left hand against a wall, fingers spread. He took 5 razor blades in his right hand, took careful aim, and threw them at the wall. Each blade stuck into the wall between Mr. Krupp's fingers. It was like a top knife thrower's act in miniature. Mr. Krupp took his hand away, leaving the blades in the wall outlining the place his fingers had been, and he turned to his partner for approval. Mr. Vandermeer was unimpressed. "What's so clever about that, then?" he asked. "You didn't even hit one finger." Mr. Krupp sighed.
"Ah, I didn't," he said. "Well, slit my gullet, you're right. How could I have been such a ninny?"
He pulled the razor blades out of the wall, one by one, and dropped them onto the wooden table.
"Why don't you show me how it should have been done?"
Mr. Vandermeer nodded. He put his centipede back into its empty marmalade jar. Then he put his left hand against the wall. He raised his right arm. His knife, wicked and sharp and perfectly weighted, was in his right hand. He narrowed his eyes, and he threw. The knife flew through the air, like an extremely large and sharp knife flying through the air very fast indeed. It thudded into the damp plaster wall, blade first. The blade having first hit and penetrated the back of Mr. Vandermeer's hand on its way. A telephone began to ring. Mr. Vandermeer looked around, satisfied, with the knife still through his hand. "That's how it's done," he said. There was an old telephone in the corner of the room. An antique, 2-part telephone, unused in the hospital since the 1920s, made of wood and bakelite. Mr. Krupp picked up the earpiece, which was on a long cloth-wrapped cord, and spoke into the mouthpiece, which was attached to the base.
Krupp and Vandemar, he said smoothly. The old firm. Obstacles obliterated, nuisances eradicated, bothersome limbs removed, and tutelary dentistry.
The person at the other end of the phone said something. Mr. Krupp cringed. Mr. Vandemar tugged at his left hand. It was pinned hard to the wall and wasn't coming free.
Oh, yes, sir, yes, indeed. And might I say how your telephonic confabulation brightens up and cheers our otherwise dreary and uneventful day?
Another pause.
Of course I'll stop toadying and crawling. Delighted to. An honour. And
what do we know? Well, we know that... An interruption. He picked his nose, reflectively, patiently. Then...
No, we don't know where she is at this precise moment. But we don't have to. She'll be at the market tonight, and...
His mouth tightened, and...
We have no intention of violating their market truce. More of waiting till she has left the market, and scrobbling her.
He was silent then, and listened, nodding from time to time. Mr. Vandemar tried to pull the knife out of the wall with his free hand, but the knife was stuck quite fast.
That might be arranged, yes, said Mr. Krupp into the mouthpiece. I mean, it will be arranged, of course. Yes, I realise that. And, sir, perhaps we could talk about...
But the caller had hung up. Mr. Krupp stared at the earpiece for a moment, and put it back on its hook.
You think you're so damn clever, he whispered.
Then he noticed Mr. Vandemar's predicament and said, Stop that. He leaned over and pulled the knife out of the wall and out of the back of Mr. Vandemar's hand and put it down on the table. Mr. Vandemar shook his left hand and flexed the fingers, then wiped the fragments of damp plaster from his knife blade.
Who was that?
Our employer, said Mr. Krupp. It seems the other one isn't going to work out. Not old enough. It's going to have to be the door female.
So we aren't allowed to kill her any more?
That, Mr. Vandemar, would be about the short and the long of it, yes. Now, it seems little Miss Dore has announced that she shall be hiring a bodyguard at the market tonight.
So? Mr. Vandemar spat on the back of his hand, where the knife had gone in, and on the palm of his hand, where the knife had come out. He rubbed at the spit with a massive thumb. The flesh closed, knitted, was whole again. Mr. Krupp picked up his old coat, heavy, black, and shiny with age, from the floor. He put it on.
So, Mr. Vandemar, he said, shall we not also hire ourselves a bodyguard?
Mr. Vandemar slid his knife back into the holster in his sleeve. He put his coat on as well, pushed his hands deep into the pockets, and was pleasantly surprised to find an almost untouched mouse in one pocket. Good. He was hungry. Then he pondered Mr. Krupp's last statement with the intensity of an anatomist dissecting his one true love. And realizing the flaw in his partner's logic, Mr. Vandemar said,
We don't need a bodyguard, Mr. Krupp. We hurt people. We don't get hurt.
Mr. Krupp turned out the lights.
Oh, Mr. Vandemar, he said,
enjoying the sound of the words as he enjoyed the sound of all words.
If you cut us, do we not bleed?
Mr. Vandemar pondered this for a moment in the dark. Then he said, perfectly accurately, No.
A spy from the upworld, said the Lord Ratspeaker. Hey, I should slit you from gullet to gizzard and tell fortunes with your guts.
Look, said Richard, his back against the wall, with the glass dagger pressed against his Adam's apple. I think you're making a bit of a mistake here. My name is Richard Mayhew. I can prove who I am. I've got my library cards, credit cards, things, he added desperately. At the opposite end of the hall, Richard noticed, with the dispassionate clarity that comes when a lunatic is about to slit your throat with a piece of broken glass, people were throwing themselves to the ground, bowing low, and remaining on the floor. A small, black shape was coming toward them along the ground.
I think a moment's reflection might prove that we're all being very silly, said Richard.
He had no idea what the words meant, just that they were coming out of his mouth, and that as long as he was talking, he was not dead.
Now, why don't you put that away? And excuse me, that's my bag.
This last to a thin, bedraggled girl in her late teens, who had taken Richard's bag and was roughly tipping his possessions out onto the ground. The people in the hall continued to bow, and to stay bowed, as the small shape came closer. It reached the group of people around Richard, although not a one of them noticed it. They were all looking at Richard. It was a rat, which looked up at Richard curiously. He had the bizarre and momentary impression that it winked one of its little black oil-drop eyes at him. Then it chittered loudly. The man with the glass dagger threw himself on his knees. So did the people gathered around them. So, too, after a moment's hesitation and a little more awkwardly, did the homeless man, the one they had called Iliaster. In a moment, Richard was the only one standing. The thin girl tugged at his elbow, and he, too, went down on one knee. Lord Ratspeaker bowed so low his long hair brushed the ground, and he chittered back at the rat, wrinkling his nose, showing his teeth, squeaking and hissing for all the world like an enormous rat himself.
"Look, can anybody tell me?"
muttered Richard.
"Quiet!" said the girl.
The rat stepped, a little disdainfully, it seemed, into the Lord Ratspeaker's grubby hand, and the man held it, respectfully, up in front of Richard's face. It waved its tail languidly as it inspected Richard's features.
"This is Master Longtail of the Clan Grey," said the Lord Ratspeaker. "He says you look exceeding familiar. He wants to know if he's met you afore."
Richard looked at the rat. The rat looked at Richard.
"I suppose it's possible," he admitted. "He says he was discharging an obligation to the Marquis de Carabas."
Richard stared at the animal more closely.
"It's that rat? Oh, yes, we've met. Actually, I threw the TV remote control at it."
Some of the people standing round looked shocked. The thin girl actually squeaked. Richard hardly noticed them. At least something was familiar in this madness.
"Hello, Ratty," he said. "Good to see you again. Do you know where Dor is?" "Ratty," said the girl, in something between a squeak and a horrified swallow.
She had a large, water-stained red button pinned to her ragged clothes, of the sort that comes attached to birthday cards. It said, in yellow letters, "I am 11. Lord Ratspeaker waved his glass dagger admonishingly at Richard.
"You must not address Master Longtail, save through me," he said.
The rat squeaked an order. The man's face fell.
"Him?"
he said, looking at Richard disdainfully.
"Look, I can't spare a soul. How about if I simply slice his throat and send him down to the sewer folk?"
The rat chittered once more, decisively, and then leapt from the man's shoulder onto the ground and vanished into one of the many holes that lined the walls. The Lord Ratspeaker stood up. 100 eyes were fixed on him. He turned back to the hall and looked at his subjects crouched beside their greasy fires.
"I don't know what you lot are all looking at," he shouted. "Who's turning the spits, hey? You want the grub to burn? There's nothing to see. Go on, get away with the lot of you."
Richard stood up nervously. His left leg had gone numb, and he rubbed life into it as it prickled with pins and needles. Lord Ratspeaker looked at Iliaster.
He's got to be taken to the market. Master Longtail's orders.
Iliaster shook his head and spat onto the ground.
Well, I'm not taking him, he said. More than my life's worth, that journey. You rat speakers have always been good to me, but I can't go back there. You know that.
The Lord Rat Speaker nodded. He put his dagger away in the furs of his robe. Then he smiled at Richard with yellow teeth.
You don't know how lucky you were just then, he said.
Yes, I do, said Richard. I really do.
No, said the man. You don't. You really don't.
And he shook his head and said to himself, marvelling,
Ratty.
The Lord Rat Speaker took Iliaster by the arm, and the two of them walked a little way out of earshot and began to talk, darting looks back at Richard as they did so. The thin girl was gulping down one of Richard's bananas. In what was, Richard reflected, the least erotic display of banana eating he had ever seen.
You know, that was going to be my breakfast, said Richard.
She looked up at him guiltily.
My name's Richard. What's yours?
The girl, who, he realized, had already managed to eat most of the fruit that Richard had brought with him, swallowed the last of the banana and hesitated. Then she half smiled and said something that sounded a lot like anesthesia.
I was hungry, she said.
Well, so am I, he told her.
She glanced at the little fires across the room. Then she looked back at Richard. She smiled again.
Do you like cat?
She said.
Yes, said Richard. I quite like cats.
Anesthesia looked relieved.
Thigh?
She asked.
Or breast?
The girl called Dor and walked down the court, followed by the Marquis de Carabas. There were 100 other little courts and mews and alleys in London, just like this one, tiny spurs of old time, unchanged for 300 years. Even the smell of piss here was the same as it had been in Pepys's time, 300 years before. There was still an hour until dawn, but the sky was beginning to lighten, turning a stark leaden colour. Strands of mist hung like livid ghosts on the air. The door was roughly boarded up and covered with stained posters for forgotten bands and long-closed night spots. The two of them stopped in front of it, and the Marquis eyed it, all boards and nails and posters, and he appeared unimpressed. But then unimpressed was his default state.
So this is the entrance, he said.
She nodded. One of them. He folded his arms.
Well, say open sesame or whatever it is that you do.
I don't want to do this, she said. I'm really not sure that we're doing the right thing.
Very well.
He unfolded his arms. I'll be seeing you then. He turned on his heel and began to walk back the way that they had come. Dor seized his arm.
You'd abandon me?
She asked. Just like that? He grinned, without humour.
Certainly. I'm a very busy man. Things to see, people to do.
Look, hold on.
She let go of his sleeve, bit her lower lip.
The last time I was here...
She trailed off.
The last time you were here, you found your family dead. Well, there you go. You don't have to explain it any more.
If we aren't going in, then our business relationship is at an end. She looked up at him, her elfin face pale in the pre-dawn light.
And that's all.
I could wish you the best of luck in your future career, but I'm afraid I rather doubt you'll live long enough to have one.
You're a piece of work, aren't you?
He said nothing. She walked back toward the door.
Well,
she said,
come on, I'll take us in.
Dor put her left hand on the boarded-up door, and with her right hand she took the Marquis's huge brown hand. her tiny fingers twined into his larger ones. She closed her eyes. Something whispered and shivered and changed, and the door collapsed into darkness. The memory was fresh, only a few days old. Door moved through the house without doors, calling, "I'm home," and "Hello?" She slipped from the anteroom to the dining room, to the library, to the drawing room. No one answered. She moved to another room. The swimming pool was an indoor Victorian structure, constructed of marble and of cast iron. Her father had found it when he was younger, abandoned and about to be demolished, and he had woven it into the fabric of the house without doors. Perhaps in the world outside, in London above, the room had long been destroyed and forgotten. Dor had no idea where any of the rooms of her house were, physically. Her grandfather had constructed the house, taking a room from here, a room from there, all through London, discreet and doorless. Her father had added to it. She walked along the side of the old swimming pool, pleased to be home, puzzled by the absence of her family. And then she looked down. There was someone floating in the water, trailing twin clouds of blood behind him, one from the throat, one from the groin. It was her brother, Arch. His eyes were open wide and sightless. She realized that her mouth was open. She could hear herself screaming. "That hurt," said the Marquis. He rubbed his forehead hard, twisted his head around on his neck as if he were trying to ease a sudden painful crick. "Memories," she explained. "They're imprinted in the walls." He raised an eyebrow. "You could have warned me." "Ah," she said. "Right." They were in a huge white room. Every wall was covered with pictures. Each picture was of a different room. The white room contained no doors, no openings of any kind. "Interesting decor," acknowledged the Marquis. "This is the entrance hall. We can go from here to any room in the house. They're all linked." "And where are the other rooms located?" She shook her head. "I don't know. Miles away, probably. They're scattered all over the underside." The Marquis had managed to cover the whole room in a series of impatient strides. "Quite remarkable. An associative house, every room of which is located somewhere else. So imaginative. Your grandfather was a man of vision, Dor." "I never knew him." She swallowed, then continued, talking to herself as much as to him. "We should have been safe here. Nobody should have been able to hurt us. Only my family could move around it." "Let's hope your father's journal gives us some clues," he said. "Where do we start looking?" Dor shrugged. "You're certain he kept a journal?" he pressed. She nodded. "He used to go into his study and private the links until he'd finished dictating." "Well, we'll start in the study then."
"But I looked there. I did. I looked there when I was cleaning up the body."
And she began to cry in low, raging sobs that sounded like they were being tugged from inside her. "There, there," said the Marquis de Carabas awkwardly, patting her shoulder. And he added, for good measure, "There." He did not comfort well. Dor's odd-coloured eyes were filled with tears.
Can you just give me a sec? I'll be fine."
He nodded and walked to the far end of the room. When he looked back, she was still standing there, on her own, silhouetted in the white entrance chamber filled with pictures of rooms, and she was hugging herself and shuddering and crying like a little girl. Richard was still upset about the loss of his bag. The Lord Rat Speaker remained unmoved. He stated baldly that the rat, Master Longtail, had said nothing at all about returning Richard's things, just that he was to be taken to market. Then he told Anesthesia that she was taking the Upworlder to the market and that, yes, it was an order, and to stop snivelling and to get a move on. He told Richard that if he, Lord Ratspeaker, ever saw him, Richard, again, then he, Richard, would be in a great deal of trouble. He reiterated that Richard did not know how lucky he was, and, ignoring Richard's request that he return Richard's stuff, or at least the wallet, he led them to a door and locked it behind them. Richard and Anesthesia walked into the darkness, side by side. She carried an improvised lamp, made of a candle, a tin, some wire, and a wide-mouthed glass lemonade bottle. Richard was surprised how quickly his eyes became used to the near darkness. They seemed to be walking through a succession of underground vaults and storage cellars. Sometimes he thought he could see movement in far corners of the vaults, but whether human or rat or something else altogether, it was always gone by the time they reached the place it had been. When he tried to talk to Anesthesia about the movements, she hissed him to silence. He felt a cold draught on his face. The rat girl squatted without warning, put down her candle lamp, and tugged and pulled hard at a metal grill set in the wall. It opened suddenly, sending her sprawling. She motioned Richard to go through. He crouched, edged through the hole in the wall. After about a foot, the floor stopped completely.
"Excuse me," whispered Richard. "There's a hole here."
"It's not a big drop," she told him. "Go on."
She shut the grill behind her. She was now uncomfortably close to Richard.
"Here,"
she said. She gave him the handle of her little lamp to hold and clambered down into the darkness.
"There," she said. "That wasn't that bad, was it?"
Her face was a few feet below Richard's dangling feet.
"Here, pass me the lamp."
He lowered it down to her. She had to jump to take it from him.
"Now," she whispered. "Come on."
He edged nervously forward, climbed over the edge, hung for a moment, then let go. He landed on his hands and feet in soft, wet mud. He wiped the mud off his hands onto his sweater. A few feet forward, and Anesthesia was opening another door. They went through it, and she pulled it closed behind them.
"We can talk now," she said. "Not loud, but we can, if you want to."
"Oh, thanks," said Richard. He couldn't think of anything to say.
"So, you're a rat, are you?"
he said. She giggled, like a Japanese girl, covering her face with her hand as she laughed. Then she shook her head and said,
"I should be so lucky. I wish. Nah, I'm a rat speaker. We talk to rats."
"What, just chat to them?"
"Oh, no. We do stuff for them. I mean..."
And her tone of voice implied that this was something that might never have occurred to Richard unassisted.
"There are some things rats can't do, you know. I mean, not having fingers and thumbs and things. Hang on."
She pressed him against the wall suddenly and clamped a filthy hand over his mouth. Then she blew out the candle. Nothing happened. Then he heard distant voices. They waited in the darkness and the cold. Richard shivered. People walked past them, talking in low tones. When all sounds had died away, Anesthesia took her hand from Richard's mouth, relit the candle, and they walked on.
"Who were they?"
asked Richard. She shrugged. "It don't matter," she said.
"Well, then what makes you think that they wouldn't have been pleased to see us?"
She looked at him rather sadly, like a mother trying to explain to an infant that, yes, this flame was hot too. All flames were hot. Trust her, please. Come on, she said. I know a shortcut. We can nip through London above for a bit. They went up some stone steps, and the girl pushed open a door. They stepped through, and the door closed shut behind them. Richard looked around, puzzled. They were standing on the embankment, that miles-long walkway which the Victorians built along the north shore of the Thames, covering the drainage system and the newly created district line of the underground, and replacing the stinking mud flats which had festered along the banks of the Thames for the previous 500 years. It was still night, or perhaps it was night once more. He was unsure how long they had been walking through the underplaces and the dark. There was no moon, but the night sky was a riot of crisp and glittering autumn stars. There were streetlights, too, and lights on buildings and on bridges which looked like earthbound stars, and they glimmered, repeated, as they were reflected with the city and the night water of the Thames. It's fairyland, thought Richard. Anesthesia blew out her candle, and Richard said, Are you sure this is the right way? Yes, she said, pretty sure. They were approaching a wooden bench, and the moment he set eyes on it, it seemed to Richard that that bench was one of the most desirable objects he had ever seen. Can we sit down? He asked. Just for a minute. She shrugged. They sat down at opposite ends of the bench. On Friday, said Richard, I was with one of the finest investment analysts in London. What's that investment Anna thing? It was my job. She nodded, satisfied. Right, and? Just reminding myself, really. Yesterday, it was like I didn't exist anymore to anybody up here. That's 'cause you don't, explained Anesthesia. A late-night couple, who had been slowly walking along the embankment toward them, holding hands, sat down in the middle of the bench between Richard and Anesthesia and commenced to kiss each other passionately. Excuse me, said Richard to them. The man had his hand inside the woman's sweater and was moving it around enthusiastically, a lone traveller discovering an unexplored continent. I want my life back, Richard told the couple. I love you, said the man to the woman. But your wife, she said, licking the side of his face. Fuck her, said the man. Don't want to fuck her, said the woman and giggled drunkenly. Want to fuck you. She put a hand on his crotch and giggled some more. Oh, come on, said Richard to Anesthesia, feeling that the bench had started to become a less desirable neighbourhood. And they got up and walked away. Anesthesia peered back, curiously, at the couple on the bench who were gradually becoming more horizontal. Richard said nothing. Something wrong? Asked Anesthesia. Only everything, said Richard. Have you always lived down there? Nah, I was born up here, she hesitated. You don't want to hear about me. Richard realized, almost surprised, that he really did. I do. Really. She fingered the rough quartz beads that hung in a necklace around her neck, and she swallowed. There was me and Mum and the twins, she said, and then she stopped talking, her mouth clamped shut. Go on, said Richard. It's all right. Really it is. Honest. The girl nodded. She took a deep breath. And then she began to talk, without looking at him as she talked, her eyes fixed on the ground ahead of her. Well, Mum had me and my sisters, but she got a bit funny in the head. One day I got home from school, and she was crying and crying, and she didn't have any clothes on, and she was breaking stuff. Plates and stuff. But she never hurt us. She never did. A lady from the social services came and took the twins away, and I had to go and stay with my aunt. She was living with this bloke. I didn't like him. And when she was out of the house... The girl paused. She was quiet for so long that Richard wondered if she had finished. Then she began once more. Anyway, he used to hurt me. Do other stuff. In the end, I told my aunt, and she started hitting me. Said I was lying. Said she'd have the police on me. But I wasn't lying, so I ran away. It was my birthday. They had reached the Albert Bridge, a kitsch monument spanning the Thames, joining Battersea to the south with the Chelsea end of the embankment. A fairy tale bridge hung with thousands of tiny white lights. I didn't have anywhere to go, and it was so cold, said Anesthesia, and she stopped again. I slept on the streets. I'd sleep in the day when it was a bit warmer and walk round at night just to keep moving. I was only 11, stealing bread and milk off people's doorsteps to eat. Hated doing that, so I started hanging around the street markets, taking the rotten apples and oranges and things people threw away. And then I got really sick. I was living under a flyover in Notting Hill. When I come to, I was in London below. The rats had found me. Have you ever tried to return to all this? Quiet, warm, inhabited houses, late-night cars, the real world. She shook her head. All fire burns, little baby. You'll learn. You can't. It's one or the other. Nobody ever gets both. I'm sorry, said Dor, hesitantly. Her eyes were red, and she looked as if she had been vigorously blowing her nose and scrubbing her tears from her eyes and cheeks. The Marquis, who had been amusing himself, playing a game of knuckle bones with some old coins and bones he kept in one of the many pockets of his coat, looked up at her coldly. Indeed. She bit her lower lip. No, not really. I'm not sorry. I've been running and hiding and running so hard that this was the first chance I've really had to... She stopped. The Marquis swept up the coins and the bones and returned them to their pocket. After you, he said. He followed her back to the wall of pictures. She put one hand on the painting of her father's study and took the Marquis's large black hand with the other. Reality... twisted. They were in the conservatory, watering the plants. First, Portia would water a plant, directing the flow of the water toward the soil at the base of the plant, avoiding the leaves and the blossoms. Water the shoes, she said to her youngest daughter, not the clothes. Ingress had her own little watering can. She was so proud of it. It was just like her mother's, made of steel, painted bright green. As her mother finished with a plant, Ingress would water it with her tiny watering can. On the shoes, she told her mother. She began laughing then, spontaneous little girl laughter. And her mother laughed too, until foxy Mr. Croup pulled her hair back hard and sudden and cut her white throat from ear to ear. Hello, Daddy, said Dor, quietly. She touched the bust of her father with her fingers, stroking the side of his face. A thin, ascetic man, almost bald. Caesar as Prospero, thought the Marquis de Carabas. He felt a little sick. That last image had hurt, still. He was in Lord Portico's study. That was a first. The Marquis took in the room, eyes sliding from detail to detail. The stuffed crocodile hanging from the ceiling, the leather-bound books, an astrolabe, convex and concave mirrors, odd scientific instruments. There were maps on the walls of lands and cities de Carabas had never heard of, a desk covered in handwritten correspondence. The white wall behind the desk was marred by a reddish-brown stain. There was a small portrait of Dor's family on the desk. The Marquis stared at it. Your mother and your sister, your father and your brothers, all dead. How did you escape? He asked. She lowered her hand.
I was lucky. I'd gone off exploring for a few days. Did you know there are still some Roman soldiers camped out by the Kilburn River?
The Marquis had not known this, which irritated him.
How many?
She shrugged.
A few dozen. They were deserters from the 19th Legion, I think. My Latin's a bit patchy. Anyway, when I got back here...
She paused, swallowed, her opal-coloured eyes brimming with tears. "Pull yourself together," said the Marquis shortly. "We need your father's journal, and we have to find out who did this." She frowned at him.
"We know who did this. It was Krupp and Vandemar."
He opened a hand, waggled his fingers as he spoke.
"Their arms, hands,
fingers. There's a head that ordered it, that wants you dead, too. Those two don't come cheap." He looked around the cluttered office.
"His journal?" said the Marquis. "It's not here," she said. "I told you. I looked. I was under the misapprehension that your family was skilled in locating doors, both obvious and otherwise." She glowered at him. Then she closed her eyes and put her finger and thumb on each side of the bridge of her nose. Meanwhile, the Marquis examined the objects on Lord Portico's desk. An inkwell, a chess piece, a bone die, a gold pocket watch, several quill feathers, and... interesting. It was a small statue of a boar, or a crouching bear, or perhaps a bull. It was hard to tell. It was the size of a large chess piece and had been roughly carved out of black obsidian. It reminded him of something, but of what he could not say. He picked it up casually, turned it over, curled his fingers around it. Dor lowered her hand from her face. She looked puzzled and confused. "What's the matter?" he asked. "It is here," she said. Simply.
She began to walk through the study, head turning first to one side and then to the other. The Marquis slipped the carving discreetly into an inside pocket. Dor stood before a high cabinet.
"There,"
she said. She reached out a hand. There was a click, and a small panel in the side of the cabinet swung open. Dor reached into the darkness and removed something roughly the size and shape of a small cannonball. She passed it to the Marquis. It was a sphere, constructed of old brass and polished wood, inset with polished copper and glass lenses. He took it from her.
"This is it?"
She nodded. "Well done." She looked grave.
"I don't know how I could have missed it before." "You were upset," said the Marquis. "I was certain it would be here. And I am so rarely wrong now."
He held the little wooden globe up. The light caught the polished glass and glinted from the brass and copper fittings. It galled him to admit ignorance about anything, but he said it anyway.
"How does this work?"
Anesthesia had led Richard into a small park on the south side of the bridge, then down some stone steps set beside a wall. She relit her candle in a bottle, and then she opened a workman's door and closed it behind them. They went down some steps with the darkness all around them.
"There's a girl named Dor,"
said Richard.
"She's a bit younger than you. Do you know her?"
"The Lady Dor? I know who she is."
"So which, barony is she part of?"
"No barony. She's of the House of the Arch. Her family used to be very important."
"Used to be? Why did they stop?"
"Somebody killed them."
"Yes." He remembered the Marquis saying something about that now.
A rat ran across their path. Anesthesia stopped on the steps and performed a deep curtsy. The rat paused. "Sire," she said to the rat.
"Hi,"
said Richard. The rat looked at them for a heartbeat, then it darted off down the steps.
"So," said Richard, "what is a floating market?"
"It's very big," she said, "but rat speakers hardly ever need to go to the market, to tell the truth."
She hesitated.
"Nah, you'll laugh at me."
"I won't," said Richard, honestly.
"Well," said the thin girl, "I'm a little scared."
"Scared of the market?"
They had reached the bottom of the steps. Anesthesia hesitated and then turned left.
"Oh, no. There's a truce in the market. If anyone hurt anyone there, the whole of London below will be down on them like a ton of sewage."
"So, what are you scared of?"
"Getting there. They hold it in a different place every time. It moves around. And to get to the place it'll be tonight..."
She fingered the quartz beads around her neck, nervously.
"We'll have to go through a really nasty neighbourhood."
She did sound scared. Richard suppressed the urge to put an arm around her.
"And where would that be?"
he asked. She turned to him, pushed the hair from her eyes and told him.
"Knightsbridge?" repeated Richard,
and he began to chuckle, gently. The girl turned away.
"See," she said, "I said you'd laugh."
The deep tunnels had been dug in the early days of the Second World War. Troops had been quartered there in their thousands, their waste needing to be pumped up by compressed air to the level of the sewers far above. Both sides of the tunnels had been lined with metal bunk beds for the troops to sleep on. There had been plans to assimilate the tunnels into a high-speed extension to the underground system, but these plans came to nothing. And when the war ended, the bunk beds had stayed in the tunnels, and on their wire bases cardboard boxes were stored, each box filled with letters and files and papers, secrets of the dullest kind, stored down deep to be forgotten. Economies had closed the deep tunnels completely in the early 1990s. The boxes of secrets were removed to be scanned and stored on computers, or shredded, or burned. Varney made his home in the deepest of the deep tunnels, far beneath Camden Town Tube. He had piled abandoned metal bunk beds in front of the only entrance. Then he had decorated. Varney liked weapons. He made his own out of whatever he could find, or take, or steal. Parts of cars and rescued bits of machinery, which he turned into hooks and shivs, crossbows and arbalests, small mangonels and trebuchets for breaking walls, cudgels, glaives and knobkerries. They hung on the wall of the deep tunnel, or sat in corners, looking unfriendly. Varney looked like a bull might look, if the bull were to be shaved, dehorned, covered in tattoos, and had suffered from complete dental breakdown. Also, he snored. The oil lamp next to his head was turned down low. Varney slept on a pile of rags, snoring and snuffling, with the hilt of a homemade two-bladed sword on the ground beside his hand. A hand turned up the oil lamp. Varney had the two-bladed sword in his hand and was on his feet almost before his eyes were open. He blinked, stared around him. There was no one there. Nothing had disturbed the pile of bunk beds blocking the door. He began to lower the sword. A voice said,
"Psst!"
"Huh?" said Varney.
"Surprise!"
said Mr. Croup, stepping into the light. Varney took a step back. A mistake. There was a knife at his temple, the point of the blade next to his eye.
Further movements are not recommended, said Mr. Krupp, helpfully. Mr. Vandemar might have a little accident with his old toad sticker. Most accidents do. A